Blog Talk Radio.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn the signs of autism at AutismSpeaks.org. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Good morning and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you for waking up this morning and listening to the show. I hope you had a great week. It's a beautiful day here in Philadelphia, bright and sunny, ready to go out and take over the world. And I have a wonderful guest with me this morning, Susan J. Douglas. She's the author of Enlightened Sexism. I just want to read a little bit from her book this morning. The United States still ranks 69th in the world in terms of number of women in national legislatures. Only 17% of the seats in the United States House of Representatives are held by women, whereas in Rwanda, it's 56%. America continues to rank 29th in infant mortality rates, 17 places lower than it did in 1960, and now behind Cuba, the Czech Republic, and Hungary, and tied with Slovakia and Poland. And I could go on. She has a whole bunch of other statistics in the book, but I want to say good morning to you.
Good morning, Joy.
Thank you so much for coming on the show this morning. For the listeners out there, you might have heard of the shows Buffy, Xena, Alias. I'm sure you're aware of Gossip Girl. And Susan and I just mentioned Toddlers and Tiaras. All these different shows have some positive messages, and yet there's an underlying issue, and that's what Susan's book really highlights. Why don't you define what you consider enlightened sexism, Susan? What is enlightened sexism, your definition?
Well, you know, it refers to, a new kind of environment and a new sort of set of messages that are out there for women and especially young women. And it is a new, subtle, sneaky form of sexism that on the surface seems to accept and even embrace women's equality and women's achievements, but underneath is really dedicated to keeping women, and especially young women, in their place, and also to repudiating feminism as no longer necessary, and in fact, something that will make young women desperately unhappy.
Well, you know, I was reading the book, and in her book she talks about the issue of Gossip Girl, and my daughter reacted similar to how your daughter reacted when you were trying to talk to her about the scenes and the sex, and she just cried, "Oh, Mom, can't you just watch it and be happy, you know?" My problem with the show like Gossip Girl is that there are very little consequences to the actions that are happening in terms of, you know, yes, the young ladies are empowered and they're not afraid of their sexuality, but where is the talk of using a condom? Where is the issue of dealing with abortion? Where is the issue of dealing with sexually transmitted diseases?
Yeah, you know, I watch Gossip Girl pretty regularly, and so does my daughter, and it's simultaneously for me a guilty pleasure and also something that I find very troubling at the same time. And I think, you know, for most women in America, we do have a love-hate relationship with the mass media, in part because, you know, the mass media have a love-hate relationship with us. So, you know, I think Gossip Girl in some ways is better than it should be, and what makes it interesting is the kind of arch voiceover and the irony of the show that, you know, it's so over the top in the way that we're not supposed to take it seriously. It mm-hmm. does make fun of this notion that's been circulating in pop culture that the most powerful people in society right now are bullying teenage girls. You know, and it sort of sends that up. And on the other hand, you know, as you very rightly point out, this and many other shows that are watched by young people actually have fewer references to the consequences of sexual activity than a show like Beverly Hills 90210 did back in the early 90s. So, you know, it's a very mixed fantasy of girls having power on the one hand, and yet girls deploying that power in very noxious girl-on-girl, you know, violence and bullying.
Well, that's one of the issues you talked about, violence. Like, for example, you talk about Buffy, the vampire slayer, and how, you know, that was an empowering character for women. But one of the issues I did have was the level of violence that it ended up getting to. It's like, I was glad that she was powerful. She wasn't afraid, and she was taking out the bad guys. Yet, did it have to be so violent? I mean, not that I want her to be soft and wearing pink fluffy, you know, tutu, but it seemed like an extreme. A lot of these images go to the extreme, like the woman is in power, but she's going to the extreme. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, shows like Buffy came out of a real genuine desire to show young women as powerful. And Joss Whedon, who's the creator of the show, was a self-proclaimed feminist. Buffy and Xena and other shows like them came out very much of the girl power movement in the mid-1990s. And, you know, one of the things that was interesting for me in doing this book, because it is a tour of pop culture from the 90s to the present and how women have been, you know, portrayed it, in various and sundry TV shows, movies, magazines, etc., is how much feminist ferment there was in the early and mid-90s. You know, 92 was proclaimed the year of the woman because an unprecedented number of women ran for Congress and won.
Yeah.
You know, there were Take Back the Night rallies. Their Reviving Ophelia and Backlash were bestsellers. And so it's out of this mix of a real desire to have role model women on television, to have women and girls no longer only be the victims in horror movies, that you know, animated the creation of shows like Buffy and Xena. You know, and who doesn't want to pretend for an hour that the only one who can really save the world is a teenage girl, you know? And on the other hand, of course, you know, what the media giveth with one hand, they taketh away with the other. And, you know, so...
Well, I think they take it away with one of your book chapters, Lean and Mean, talking about Victoria's Secret. And you have a paragraph that says, I really hate Victoria's Secrets a lot. Being instantly accosted by the ever-hovering black-suited, officious young women, being dwarfed by larger-than-life black-and-white photos of breasts the size of Mount McKinley bursting out of IPEX bras. I mean, who in the world doesn't want to own a Victoria's Secret bra? I mean, it makes it look like it's so cool, it's so empowering, you're going to get the best guy, you're going to be so sexy. They forgot to mention that the bras are like $50 or more, and who can afford the bra? You know? So you can only be you can only get a guy if you have a lot of money. But then also in your book, you talk about if you have a lot of money and power, then some guys don't want you.
Yeah, well, you know, I think what really began to emerge in the 21st century was a real escalation in the sexualization of girls at ever younger and younger ages. There was the emergence of a body type that is pretty much impossible to own, which is a very slim, you know, kind of the body of a 12-year-old boy's with Pamela Anderson's boobs attached.
Well, look at Ally McBeal. I mean, that whole issue with her possible eating disorder, you know.
Well, Ally McBeal, but then you had to have the Victoria's Secret breasts. And,
yes.
You know, there was
you're going to topple over. You're going to topple over if you have the Victoria's Secret breast in the bottom of Ally McBeal, you know. I think that my concern, we both talked about being parents. You have a daughter, yes?
I do. I have a daughter who's now 21.
So what does she think about your work? Does she think you're over the top? Does she think you're right on point? I mean, Mom, calm down. What does she think of the work that you're doing?
Well, you know, as I wrote in the book, you know, I began to really focus on this stuff because I was so struck by the way in which the media were dividing us against each other when she was a teenager. And I had one kind of fantasy of power laid before me with all of these DAs and lawyers and, you know, surgeons at night. And she was watching MTV when she was a teenager. And it was all of these reality TV shows, Sorority Girl, The Real World, et cetera, where, you know, young women were shopaholic bimbos who got into catfights and obsessed about men in relationships. And so...
Isn't that what women do? Don't we go to lunch and talk about men all day long?
Yeah, right. And so, you know, I would hover over her and, you know, make my usual, you know, feminist-infused critiques of these shows. And when she was 15, she did not appreciate this at all.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, she's 21 now, and that's a big difference. And so she's just finished reading the book, and she feels – and not only does she feel it spot on, her her friends feel it's spot on, and they are now seeing the kind of enlightened sexism I've talked about everywhere. So it's been really gratifying to me to have a daughter who used to think, you know, I was nuts and also embarrassing, now say, God, you're right, you know?
Yeah. Now, you also have a book called The Mommy Myth, and you do mention in enlightened sexism, just the issue of the women trying to juggle. On TV, it's like seems so easy, you know, that women can be moms, go to work. But one of the flaws, I'm an African-American woman, is that when I look at these, there's a majority of them are white women on TV, and I don't have anything to relate to. You do have a whole chapter about You Go Girl and, Living Single, and I love that show, Living Single, because I totally could relate on some level to the characters, but at the same time, it goes back to the enlightened sexism. They had the mean girl character, Max, and, she had to be so coarse. She was the most powerful. She made the most money, and yet she had all these problems trying to have relationships. It's like, do we have any well-rounded, balanced characters anywhere, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, it was really important for me to, to include that chapter. And I loved Living Single also when it came out as well, despite, again, its problems. I, like you, really had problems with the Max character, because why is it that the woman who's sort of the most professionally successful has to have the most trouble with relationships and also be the most sexually aggressive, you know? But, you know, I'm a dead sucker for Queen Latifah. And
Well, I think she's a great role model. I think she's, for me, Queen Latifah, her music, and she continues to, I think, be a very good role model. In terms of African-American women in the media, let's talk about Michelle Obama. I mean, there was this whole stream of media that she was this angry black woman and don't mess with my husband because if you do, I'm going to beat you down, you know. Also the issue of her physical, showing her legs, showing her arms, you know, the Venus Hottentot type of stuff going on. What do you think about that?
Well, I did want to, in the book, go back and forth as much as I could between real women, you know, politicians, et cetera, prominent women in the media, and, you know, the kind of fictional television as well. And so it was important to write about the 2008 campaign and how Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin and Michelle Obama were portrayed. And what I was so struck with was Michelle Obama. I mean, look, here is this elegant, smart, incredibly accomplished, gorgeous woman who enters the scene, and the archetype of the sassy, angry black woman is just so prevalent and so available and has been so used for laughs in so many TV shows that it was just right there to slap on her as soon as she came out, and as a prominent woman in the campaign. And she has had to be very, very careful in how she has cast herself as First Lady, because those kinds of stereotypes of African-American women as mouthy, as sassy, as talk to the hand, you know, as domineering, so on and so forth, are just so everywhere that she has had to be very careful about focusing on children and family issues, being mom in chief, and all the rest. And the stuff about her arms, I mean, my goodness, I think people
it was
have
just
way too
ridiculous.
Much time on their hands.
Yeah, exactly, ridiculous. Now, one thing you do talk about in the book is, I don't know if I want to use the word enamored, but you were happy for certain characters, these African-American characters who, like Wanda Sykes, her comedy, she was able to freely express herself and talk back to, you know, the chauvinistic, you know, patriarchy, whereas you felt that in the book you discussed that you felt white women couldn't do that and still continue to be professional somehow, but you still love this Wanda Sykes character. Talk to me about that.
Well, there, one of the things I was really wanted to confront is the success of this kind of, you know, sassy, mouthy, you know, African-American woman who, you know, can code switch, go back and forth between, you know, sort of official white English and black speak. Mm-hmm. And, you know, white women love those, you know, kind of black female characters. And I wanted to know and explore why that was, and how my love for, and I adore Wanda Sykes, and I love her humor. Every stand-up thing I think is better than the next.
I love her comedy, too. I think she's spot on. I think she's great, and I think she tells it like it is. I guess I had a show recently about a book called Shifting, and it dealt with African-American women and how they have to shift between their professional persona, their personal persona, you know, the persona in the community as moms, as single women, the issues of sexuality, all these things, and how they have to constantly shift the stress that is brought on by that. It's just as difficult for African-American women to deal with this issue of feminism, because, you know, in the black movement, it was like wrong for a black woman to be a feminist, you know, and you do mention that briefly, and how a lot of black feminists felt maybe ostracized from the white feminist movement. But I think it's the same issue whether you're black or white. Sexism is sexism, you know, chauvinism is chauvinism, and we all as women have to deal with this. How we deal with it is different maybe because of culture. But now, what do you think going forward? Like, what do you think about the show Gilmore Girls? That was a single mom taking care of this young woman, very smart, you know, she was had her own business. What do you think about that show?
Well, you know, in a book like this, you have to make choices about...
Yeah, you can't talk about everything.
...what you're going to include and what you're not. And, you know, it is one of the shows I didn't include. You know, again, I think that show was a double-edged sword. You know, on the one hand, it was a lovely fantasy, you know, to have this mother and daughter be so close. And yet, you know, when my daughter was 15 and we were not so close, kind of tyrannical, you know, that there was no way I had that kind of relationship. So, you know, it was an interesting show and a kind of a double-edged sword in that way, I think. But a lot of people loved it for the reasons
you
suggest.
Now, one thing you do talk about, let's talk about the guys. We got to talk about the men. You have a whole chapter called Castration Anxiety. And with the rise of all this, you know, girl power and female power, you know, men were getting afraid. They were just getting fearful. And that, like, it's okay for a woman to be sexually powerful, but don't be too sexually aggressive. It's okay for her to, you know, be like Alias. Like, I love the show Alias. But at the same time, I realized the whole her sexualization and her scantily clad costume sometimes just got like, come on, in no way in the world she's gonna be able to do that kick, jump, and fly and keep that thing on in real life. She probably has double faced tape underneath like the Olympic athletes do, you know, when they're doing gymnastics. But why do you think men are afraid of women having power?
Well, because some of them feel that it will take away from their power. It's really simple. So there are some men who don't want to give up their prerogative, you know, and there are other men who see women having equality as actually very liberating for them. But, you know, when you have women pushing for sexual agency and sexual equality, you know, around pay and educational opportunities and all the rest, there are some men who are threatened, and you began to have kind of coursing through the culture in the mid and late 1990s, a sense of reaction to this changing gender regime that, it wasn't just baby boom feminists anymore. It was young women. It was women in their 20s and 30s who were then taking up the torch and saying, okay, you know, second wave feminists got so far, but there's still work to be done. And, you know, so there's going to be both institutionally and individually pushback against that. And so I do think that enlightened sexism began to start to swirl around and take hold in the mid and late 1990s and then consolidate in the 21st century as, you know, a particular reaction to feminism and also an effort to accommodate it and contain it in a particular way.
Yes, one of your, the F word in your epilogue, you say, in fact, researchers have documented the persistence of ambivalent sexism, a seemingly paradoxical amalgam of hostility and chivalry toward women. Some men resent that women have come too far, hostile sexism, while others put them up on a pedestal, benevolent sexism. But many men hold both negative and positive attitudes toward women that sustain enlightened sexism. I mean, I think we constantly struggle as human beings about, you know, the feminine side and the masculine side. You talk about the book, was that Women, Men Are from Mars, Women Are from Venus or something, how, you know, I thought that was a bunch of crap myself. I think people encompass different aspects, and at different times you need to show those in terms of your feminine and masculine side if we want to label it feminine and masculine, because I think one of the issues with the characters in a lot of media is that if the woman is strong and powerful, then she's being manly. Well, why is she not still a woman, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that people are constantly battling with that. But, let's talk about Little Miss Sunshine.
Oh.
I don't know if the audience is aware of this movie. It's called Little Miss Sunshine. But I don't want to give away the whole movie, but it's a must-see, and Susan discusses it in her book a little bit. But I mentioned to Susan about the movie Kick-Ass, where there's a little girl in Kick-Ass, and I'm not sure if the audience has seen it, but if you have, you know what I'm talking about. And she's being brainwashed by her father because he's obsessed with revenge. And she has, like, these magnificent, you know, Bruce Lee moves. But at the same time, you know, there's some sexuality, and her father's called Big Daddy, you know. And Little Miss Sunshine, talk to the audience a little bit about that, Susan, and your views about that movie.
Well, it is about a family who is determined to help take their daughter, who in the movie is about, I would say, 10, to the Little Miss Sunshine beauty contest because she has her heart set on entering it. And it's an odyssey where they go across country in this broken down VW van to try to get to the contest. And at the end, and they get there just in time, and she's able to enter. And I don't want to do a spoiler on it, but
I know, but we got to tell them a little
but
bit.
Let's just say that what this movie does that is so interesting is so she enters the contest, and we see all of these little girls, the JonBenet Ramsey types, who are very sexualized and done up and learn how to strut their stuff on stage. And what this movie tries to do, and I think succeeds in doing, is to make that strange. To make the fact that we do have beauty contests for little girls to try to make it strange. Now, having said that, what has the Learning Channel done? They have taken that movie as some bizarre, twisted inspiration for this TV show they have on called Toddlers and Tiaras.
Mm-hmm.
And these are little girls still in diapers, many of them, who have cans sprayed on them, their hair teased up, lips.
Tammy Faye Baker eyelashes, you know.
And they have to learn how to strut their stuff on stage. This is, you know, as a result
it's voyeuristic to me, this whole stream of reality TV. You know, we talk about Survivor, we got The Bachelor. Oh, we didn't even talk about that. We only have 7 minutes left, but, I mean, the show The Bachelor, and then they brought in a woman, you know, a woman version of the show. What do you think about those shows where, I mean, you know, people are having difficulty finding partners, you know, lifelong partners, finding men to make a commitment. Are these shows not a good thing, helping, you know, one woman find a guy? What do you think about this?
Well, I think on The Bachelor, again, you know, when women watch something, we have to pay attention to and think about why. And, I mean, on the one hand, I think the show is horrid. You know, it's basically a harem format in which one guy, you know, it's like taking a little boy to a Lego store.
Mm-hmm, candy shop, yeah.
You know, play with 25 Legos until he eliminates them all, finds the one he likes best. It's the same thing with sampling the wares of 25 women. On the other hand, I don't think young women watch the show for the guy, for the bachelor. They are looking at the other women and trying to calibrate, because deep in their hearts, young women know they're still in a male-dominated society, even if they don't say that to themselves consciously. And so they're looking to see what kind of blend of femininity and feminism is successful, works.
And getting the bachelor, right.
Now,
when
they had the woman,
people were, like, upset that, oh, did she sleep with the guy? Did she not sleep with the guy? And there's still this double-edged sword of, you know, the woman being free with her sexuality, doing whatever she wants to do, but then you're a slut, you're a hoe.
That's right. And there was a very different code of ethics for The Bachelorette than The Bachelor. And, you know, I think ABC put on The Bachelorette in part, you know, to reverse the fantasy. But it's also their inoculation. Then they can say, look, we're not sexist because we have The Bachelorette, too. But, you know, the one.
But that's your enlightened sexism, though. But that's right there. That's right there. We hit the nail on the head. We have about 5 minutes left. So we have all these issues. What do we need to do about it, Susan? What do you think we need to do about it?
Well, you know, you and I were talking just before we went on, and I think every once in a while, you know, maybe every decade or so, we need a good jolt of consciousness raising, and to, you know, kind of rip the veneer off what we take for granted in the media and you know, don't even notice. And so I think the first step is to name this phenomenon for what it is. And, you know, what I'm finding in the reaction I'm getting to the book so far is that young women are saying, yeah, this name's this thing that I couldn't name because I've been told my whole life I can do and be anything I want. And yet I get out in the workforce and, not so much, you know. And so I think we're at a moment now where we're struggling to kind of name what this is, and I think that's an important first step. But, you know, we have to start advocating for ourselves again. You know, there was just a big pay equity action day on April 20th. Mm-hmm. Virtually no attention paid to that in the media. Why April 20th? It takes a woman from January 1 to April 20th to make as much as a man makes in a year. So in other words, if she works a year plus January 20th,
to April 20th,
then she's making on average what her male counterpart is making. And
well,
so
I think that's the issue, is that we're being brainwashed, and you talk about that a lot in the book, of thinking that, you know, women can do anything now. We can get all kinds of jobs. We can be lawyers. We can be judges. We can have babies. We can have, you know, husbands. But in reality, we don't make as much. We in terms of getting jobs, and when we talk about single parenthood, which is, you know, a huge phenomenon here in the United States, difficulty getting jobs, difficulty keeping job because of childcare issues, lack of support maybe from the male counterpart. Then we have the issue of, you know, at work, that women are still facing, you know, being hit on and inappropriate, you know, having to file suits and not being taken seriously. I mean, going back to Anita Hill type of issue. You're lying, you're delusional, oh, you really wanted it. I mean, it's 2010, we haven't gotten past that yet?
We haven't, you know, and even for college women, I mean, it's much tougher for women who are working class women, lower middle class women.
Mm-hmm.
The pay inequities are enormous. And one of the things about the Great Recession is that 3/4 of the jobs lost were lost by men. So there are families now dependent on the woman's salary, and it's a lot less than his was, you know.
Yeah, and you know, there's a rise in domestic violence because of this stress that we're going under, men not being able to, quote-unquote, provide and feeling emasculated, I guess, you know, by this whole situation. But I want to thank you so much for coming on this morning. I mean, there's so much we could talk about. I have a whole list of other things I wanted to mention, but I think for everyone out there, check out Susan's website, Susan Douglas, SusanJDouglas.com, and her new book, The Seductive Message That Feminism's Work Is Done, Enlightened Sexism. We know the work is not done, and as I agree with Susan, we need a jolt. Her book is definitely a jolt to anybody out there. If you think that everything is fine, everything's okay, or you're trying to convince somebody else that it's not, tell them to pick up Enlightened Sexism. Thank you so much, Susan, for coming on this morning.
Thank you, Joy. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you. All right, you have a wonderful Saturday.
You too.
All right, for everybody out there, you know, I'm doing another show coming up at 11:30 with Jane Collymore. She's a U.S. volleyball team athlete, but she's also a musician, so we're going to be listening to some of her music. You can follow me on twitter.com/joykeys. You can become a fan of the show on Facebook. So I hope that you will continue to tune in for the 11:30 to 12 segment with Jane. If not, tune in next week. I'm going to have Mark McEwen, former CBS host, on the show discussing his travels through stroke. He had several strokes and what he's doing to deal with that. So tune in next Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern. May is Stroke Awareness Month. Thank you so much, and I hope you have a wonderful Saturday.
The odds of a young girl being discovered by an industry insider while singing to herself pumping gas? 1 in 300 million. The odds of the daughter of a clergyman from Severn, Maryland spending 11 weeks at number one on the U.S. singles charts? 1 in 19 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of selling over 40 million records? 1 in 800,000. The odds of this musician and performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 and 110. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.